You're listening to a podcast from 702.
A show. I am Thabo Mdluli in for Clement with you all the way up until noon. This hour, the focus falls on Marikana. 10 years later, what has changed? Now, you've been listening to the open line and the conversation that has been going on there, number of issues being raised. A major issue being raised is, of course, the culmination to the August 16th had other events, a series of violent encounters that were going on. So there was a series of violent encounters between the SAPS, Lawnmen Security, and members of the National Union of Mine Workers on the one side. You've got the striking miners, AMCU, on the other side. The first incident, for example, is reported that it occurred on the 11th of August when NUM leaders opened fire on NUM members who were on strike, resulting in two strikers being seriously wounded. During the period from the 12th to the 14th, 10 people were killed, including six mine workers who were going to work. They were not on strike. And there was also two SAPS members who were killed in clashes between striking miners and the SAPS members. Then on the afternoon of the 13th of August is when this happens. The remaining five people are known or believed to have been killed by strikers. This now taking that whole entire number to 10. Now, the killings on the 16th of August took place at two locations roughly 500 meters away from each other, with 17 people fatally wounded at each of these locations. The vast majority of fatalities were killed by R5 rifle fire. That's a summary of the story. Of course, there's a whole lot more that has happened in between all that. Live for us this morning in Marikana, and has largely been covering the story over time, is EWN senior reporter Teto Mahlakwana, who joins us now. Teto, good morning, and thank you very much for your time. 10 years on, trauma and sorrow of the many people there in Marikana. How are people coping? Have they managed to cope with what they witness on that week, I suppose, leading up to the 16th of August?
Good morning, Thabo. A tough question, and I think an obvious one to anyone who has experienced grief, especially grief that has got on unexpectedly and sudden and in the brutal and violent manner that this community witnessed 10 years ago. And as you do point out there in the introduction of the subject, there was a series of events that preceded today, and those events are important to also mark, and it's a big part of why Eyewitness News elected to come to Marikana a week earlier. We started our work on the ground last week, speaking to victims, speaking to people who were affected in different ways by the series of events when the mine workers decided on the 9th of August to go on a wildcat strike or unprotected strike, which was not sanctioned by any trade union. You'd remember at the time the National Union of Mine Workers had been struggling to retain control on the Northwest Platinum Belt. And another fact is that a lot of the mine workers who were on the Gobi on this day 10 years ago were in fact NUM members. They were members who had gone to their union leaders to say, we demand a 12,500 rand minimum wage. And leaders could not send that message through to management, as they were perceived to have basically given up the pursuit of the interests of workers. But coming back to your question, the sorrow is visible, the pain is still there for a lot of the families. They are yet to even begin rebuilding because their lives were snatched away from them as a consequence of the deaths of the 34 men and the 10 people who died prior, including the security guards, including the two police officials, and including those mine workers who were killed in the intimidation that had taken place as the larger number of workers had decided to down tools.
Now, I know you, for example, have been following the family of Mambush Mcinini Noki, but of course there are other families as well that have been affected by this. In fact, if you look at some of the pages on our newspapers today, there's a spread that has been bought by Sibanye-Stillwater where all the names are being put up there of the various miners that were affected. 10 years on, how are these families surviving? I mean, how are they putting their lives together?
We have not been following the Noki family this particular year because we are quite cognizant of the fact that there's many layers to how families are affected by what happened. And the life of the Noki family, of course, because of the prominence that has been afforded to them by the media in the main. I, in fact, comparatively in a different space, better, and I use that word quite, you know, subjectively, that they're in a better state than a lot of the families. This year, we spent a lot of time with the Sibambele family, which hails from the Sikisiki in the Eastern Cape. The husband was only 39 years old when he died on the 16th of August. He had been working at Lonmin, now Sibanye-Stillwater, since 2009. We sat down with his children, we sat down with his widow, and Mam Nokutula's pain, Thabo, is something that is going to take a while to escape me. She struggled from the very point of meeting us at the entry of Hostel 1 here in Marikana, where she now lives with some of her children. She struggled to hold back her tears, and she made it quite clear to us that revisiting these events does not only occur to them in August, that in fact, every time when she sees a police officer or her children see a uniformed police officer, the trauma then literally comes back and resurfaces in such a way that it's as though they have gone back to the afternoon when they discovered that Thokozile had died. And we sit down with her, and she details how, as part of the solutions that were put forth by Lonmin and carried on by Sibanye-Stillwater to the question that confronted the mining house, to say, but what then happens to those who remain behind, to the beneficiaries, to the dependents of these, you know, dead mine workers? She had to come and leave her rural home in Lusikisiki and come to the mine here in Marikana, where she now works as a cleaner. She left behind her home. She left behind her children. They had 10 children together. She then also tells us a story of just the multitude of layers of pain that this event caused in their lives, that her eldest daughter committed suicide, or took her own life rather, in 2016. And she says, had I been home, had I not been forced to leave my home in the Eastern Cape and now come work at the mines and live in this one-bedroom flat in the hostel, I would have been home to even see that my child is not well and do something about it. So it's just that, and she keeps emphasizing that in Nizivaliwe,
yeah,
their homes are permanently shut, that their homes resemble basically just a structure, because homes are people. And her children, who now are funded by the mine to go to different boarding schools in the Eastern Cape, have to keep asking her the question, but what's the point of even going home over the holidays, because there is no one? And she literally lives with the fact that her children are orphaned, albeit that she's still alive. So the wounds are deep and are gaping. And as the consequences become realer with time, they just broaden in size. And I doubt that there's anything that can be done in our lifetime to ever compensate the level of damage that getting rid of breadwinners, getting rid of heads of households has caused for a lot of these families.
I mean, she is here now, and there seems to be a sense that there is no community support structure for her family at all, unlike what she had in the Eastern Cape. So what kind of environment is she living in now?
Thabo, I think a lot of us South Africans who do intersect outside of our individual bubbles do get to interact with mining communities, and we see what hostels look like. Hostels are places where people go to live lives that they ordinarily would not lead in their home bases. That's where young men who come to the mines, very young in age, get to explore, you know, their lives. And there's a lot of drinking that happens there. When we arrived at Hostel One to go visit her, there was music blaring from speakers from all sides. There were people milling about. There were people sitting in the front verandas drinking. And there were children equally playing in on the concrete amongst all of this. And she said to me, you can look around. It was even hard to just get to a point where we could converse without there being interruption in the sound recording, because her neighbors are a family of other widows who have come to Marikana with some 7 children, because they could not even risk leaving their children behind because there was no elder to even look in on them, nor could they afford to get someone to give them the care that they deserve. So she says to me, no, you can look around. I took a walk around the one-bedroom flat. The bedroom can only fit a double bed cover. That's it. And through a doorway is a shower and a toilet, and that's what constitutes a bathroom. And you walk out the bedroom, you are greeted by a makeshift kitchen, living room, little square that does not even, I think, you know, it's not even the size of a bathroom in any other setting of a household. And she says to me, I had to leave my land where I could grow food, where I could be able to sustain my family, even if the 4,000 rand that my husband was earning at the time in 2012 could not meet all our needs. There was more that I could do. Now she is subjected to this enclosed environment where all her movements are heard by her neighbors, where her children, some of whom were just too young to leave behind, returned from boarding school here outside Rustenburg to call home. And I ask her, but how do you sleep? And I find her sitting with 5 of the children, and the eldest, 25 years old now, Tabo, was 15 when his father died. And I say, your son is quite old. How do you cope as a woman and having to raise these 5 boys in this environment? She says, I can't cope. We don't cope. All we do is wake up every day and hope tomorrow will be better. We go back to the question of compensation, because there was this push for that, the biggest outcome out of the Salam Commission, to say that there must be some financial compensation extended to these families. And had that compensation materialized in the way that it was sold by the state, with the assumption that people who have 10 dependents, like in her case, with the one now gone, 9 dependents, would get in the region of 500,000 rand and above, saying that I could actually then afford to stay at home and tend to my family and ensure that my children have a place to call home. And the crux of it was that she has no home left in Mizi Valiwe, but we have to live with the reality of seeing police officers who were a part of the collective that caused us this harm, continuing with their lives, returning home to their families every day, and, you know, bringing up the question of President Cyril Ramaphosa saying that, you know, when she saw him being appointed president, there was a breaking moment for them, because she could not understand how this is the same country where she lives, which cannot reconcile with her pain.
Do you get a sense, Teto? I mean, I know one of the things that you also a keen follower of is the recommendations of the Falun Commission and whether or not they are being implemented. For example, is government itself taking the Falun Commission recommendations seriously? 2, is the mine taking the Falun recommendations seriously?
You know, Tabo, that it takes you being on the ground in Ghana, in Marikana, to actually just see how much of that those recommendations are gathering dust in a lot of institutions. The mine had, of course, been reminded of its obligation, which is by law, to have social and labor plans that must not only be delivered for workers, but also to the community, to the nearby communities in the areas where they operate. And the state of the informal settlements around the now Sibanye-Stillwater operations, there's been no change. It's been 10 years, and yeah. If you were to do an imagery comparison and look at a picture from 2012 of the informal settlement and look at a picture of today, you may in fact see a worsening state of affairs. Yeah. There has been no attempt by both the municipality, and we must never, I think, redeem government of its responsibility of delivering services. There are still no roads, no tarred roads in Marikana, nor any of the nearby informal settlements, or even established townships which have been here longer than the mining operations themselves. There has been no housing. People still use pit latrines that you and I know take the dignity out of any human being when having to be confronted with the stench that comes with it and the unhygienic nature thereof and just how unhealthy it is. And you take that and you contrast it with then the lives of the mine workers. The biggest issue at the time of the strike was around housing. The mine workers were saying, we are forced to live in these shacks, in this informal settlement, where we arrived in the 80s, in the 70s, when we came to the mines to work. Yet, you have been promising to provide us with a form of housing. They are, tall buildings here at Tabo now. When you make your way towards the operations, you'll see the flats, you'll see the hostels that have come up since 2012. Of course, that is a sign of an implementation of part of those recommendations. But when you go deeper and you go in, you realize that this setting is quite, it bears a resemblance of how, the apartheid style hostel dwelling was done, where there was no prioritization of family units. Because the likes of the Zibandele family should not be living in a one-bedroom flat. It should have some sort of a family unit where you encourage people to be both active parents and workers. The removal of that family unit structure or the disintegration thereof begins with how people are housed. And you see that indeed the apartments have gone up. And the mine workers say, it's better because we used to wake up from checks. Now we have flushing toilets. Now we can take a warm shower when we go and report for our shift. But at the COVID, it still has not addressed the fundamental question of how we build society, which is the family unit dwelling. Then there's also the financial compensation.
Yeah.
It's been 10 years, and the mine workers excitedly will even point to their flashy cars and say, Teto, the last time we spoke, I did not have a car. I could never even dream of having a car. But now I have managed to buy myself a German sedan. You can even see the economic activity in the shopping center. You can see that there has been an injection of more money in this community. However, when you look at it and you say, in 2012, you were demanding 12,500 rand. And in 2014, you had to take the most historic action that you did as workers on the Platinum Belt and embark on a five-month strike, demanding an increase in wages, which is only at the point at which many of them actually saw that 12.5, reflect on their pay slip. Some of them say we are now sitting at 17,500 rand. And one may think that's a lot of money, but how much time has passed and how the cost of living has increased, will simply see that money being drained out to such a degree that these negotiations that they still have around wages continue to be hard, and they continue to come with a level of a threat of striking because they are not happy where they are. more so with the knowledge that the mining bosses reward themselves billions of rands every year, and this is done with that backdrop. So to answer your question, I think in a straight line, Thabo, it's hard, but there's some, you know, attempt at progress, but there's yet to be the real material difference that the kind of recommendations that are made by Jaswalam has come through. And you can even ask about the question of policing. To say the commission spoke about public order policing, to say it needs to be well capacitated, they need to be well trained. And I said in a press briefing of the security cluster a couple of weeks ago when we're reflecting on the July unrest. And it was only then when they announced the employment of 4,000 public order policing, you know, officials. And you realize this distance between what ought to be done and the urgency with which it ought to be done and the level of commitment to do so by the government. Because had the July unrest not happened and exposed the non-implementation of those regulations and rather those recommendations around public order policing, then the likelihood is those Falam recommendations would never have been carried out.
Teto Mahlakwana, I appreciate you and your detailed work here in looking at the situation 10 years on in Marikana.
Walking this talk together.
Every hour.
Every day. This is 702.
Let's walk the talk.
10:35 on the Clement Manyathela Show. I am Thabo Mdluli in for Clement as the nation looks back 10 years ago, 16th of August in 2012, that situation in Marikana. And of course, the following recommendations that have come forth from the Falam Commission. One of the agreements, at least settlement agreements that we came to on this long journey of Marikana was that those who were employed by the mine and lost their lives would be, I suppose, compensated in a manner that which would involve maybe their family members being also then hired in the mine and taking some kind of position so that the economic aspect of things is certainly being taken care of. But we hear of the atrocious conditions that they are still living in immediately from Teto Mahlakwana. Let's speak now to Asinathi Tugela, Attorney, Socioeconomic Rights Institute of South Africa. Asinathi, good morning and thank you very much for your time and for joining us this morning here on the Clement Manyathela Show. As far as how power is engaging, by power here, I'm talking about state, I'm talking about the employer itself, is engaging with the families of the victimized and vulnerable, do you think that the conduct and the practices that are being employed are in any way in keeping with our human rights ethos and what we aspire to?
Well, good morning, and thank you for having us today. You know, the saddest reflection is that 10 years after Marikana and 10 years after the biggest bloodshed incident since the dawn of democracy, we still have the same conversations around lack of compensation, lack of reparations. There hasn't been even an apology or acknowledgement of the atrocities that Marikana caused. So in that context, really, you can all easily adjust that the engagement that we've had with those that are at the helm of power haven't been conversations that are very protective and in promotion of human rights and the human rights definitions of how the state should provide reparations to people who are victims of these kind of atrocities. So the answer really is no. We haven't really observed the best practice of human rights.
Asinathi Tugela, Attorney at Socioeconomic Rights Institute of South Africa. That line not particularly clear. Let me try and hand you back to our producer, see if we can get you on a little bit of a better line or something that can be done certainly to improve that. 011-883-0702, 0727021702, 10 years on as well. We want you to reflect. Has anything changed? If so, what has changed? Particularly when you look at, for example, labor relations. Is it business as usual? When you look at the union relationships, the NUM and the AMCU, think they've smoked a peace pipe, and has their rivalry rivalry being squashed. English not cooperating with me again this morning. I wonder what's going on. Okay, let's try Asinati Tugela, Attorney, Socioeconomic Rights Institute of South Africa, if that line is a little bit better. So Asinati, I mean, the first question we put also to our EWN reporter is the way in which we are addressing the loss of financial support. It has taken 10 years, and when we are looking at it, there are some families who are saying we still have not seen a cent of the reparations that have been awarded to some claimants already. How are you tackling this question of reparations?
Okay, maybe just to give context, the civil case against the state was brought on five major demands. And the state has only brought us on a roundtable discussion to settle on one. But even on that settlement, two families are still outstanding, which means 10 years later, there are still two families that have received nothing as a result of the compensation process and the healing process of Maragana. Of the five demands, four are still outstanding. The families are at a very grave socio-economic position than they were, because first of all, they lost the family breadwinners. And even 10 years later, the state hasn't provided them with enough compensation to provide them or place them in the position where they were before. Moving forward, we've had difficulties with the state because they are either very reluctant to engage with us or cooperate with court processes. Maybe at least until recently that they have come on board and made a commitment that they want to settle this matter. So that's where I can say we are. We are trying our best to engage with the state attorney in a way of finding a resolution and the final settlement to these matters. So we are quite hopeful that in this 10-year anniversary of Maragana, we would at least find each other with the state.
So the first, you're saying reparations of just over 4 million, or at least under 4 million, was paid. This was in 2017. What has been the hold up on the balance?
Pardon me?
I'm saying, what has been the hold up on the balance of the two families that have not received anything on the first category of those who need to be paid?
So the settlement was on loss of support. In relation to the families, it's just disagreement on principle, because the state is either arguing that the deceased had no legal obligation to provide support to the dependents that remain in the family, or some other unjustifiable reason. So on that, we're still trying to engage with the state to find a common ground. But the reasons that they provide really are not in any way justifiable, because it's basically a contention on whether they are executed to support or not. Because I remember that the settlement was only just on the loss of support part of the claim. There's still emotional shock and psychological damage that is outstanding. There's still loss of family life and loss of parental care that is still outstanding. There's still also primarily the issue of an apology, because Maragana hasn't been properly recognized and acknowledged by the state as a massacre that it was. And there hasn't been any apology provided to the families that lost loved ones during Maragana.
Yeah, the second category, and particularly when it comes to reparations related to matters of malicious prosecution, arrest and detention, and some injuries, what are you claiming there, and how have matters progressed 10 years on?
Well, that is not per se our case. FIR represents the families of the deceased mine workers. Our colleagues, Anderson Gomer from Gomer Attorneys, represent the injured and arrested mine workers. So without a fear of speaking on my colleague's matter, I think what I can just mention is that there ought to be someone that takes liability for what happened in Maragana. And whether that is liability for the deaths of Maragana or for the people who were injured and maliciously prosecuted. And also to add on that, and this is something that people do not speak about the most, there are people who a week or two or months after Maragana remained in custody, being tortured by the police. Because if you remember, the police after the massacre arrested a lot of mine workers, accusing them of killing the 37 mine workers that died.
Now, the question of the apology, I mean, it's of course a question that keeps coming up over and over again, especially as it relates to the president and maybe even the government. The government would say, well, we are paying reparations already. Is that in of itself enough of an acknowledgement of accountability?
Look, it's reparations and compensation is not enough. Compensation is a legal principle, and it's out of a legal entitlement. Apology is to first give the family the comfort that there is acknowledgement of what Marikana was, and that secondly, there is ultimate regret and the efforts to ensure that Marikana is not repeated. And that is the basis of the apology. The second issue, the apology is not particularly directed to Ramaphosa. It is currently directed to him because he is the head of government. But rather, the families only want an apology, either from the president or anyone representing South African government. Remember, Marikana striking workers were killed by the police. And the police is a department or a sector of government. And someone ought to come up and take acknowledgement and take responsibility for what Marikana is on behalf of government and provide an apology, because that would be the first point of healing for the families. It is a difficult process for families to find healing if 10 years later they still feel like they are in a very bad socio-economic condition and they haven't been properly compensated. And that's just compensation. There's also reparations that come out of moral convictions of society. And we are saying that there is so much that the state and the mine as well can do to provide healing for the families without everyone being hell-bent on the compensation, which is a legal entitlement, you understand?
Yeah. 011-883-0702, 0727021702. We'll take your thoughts as well. 10 years on in Marikana, what do you see has changed? What do you see still needing to change? Asnati, this is the question of, you know, the bare minimum that the Falun Commission asked for was to see a change in the dwellings, in the accommodation arrangements of the miners. Have things improved?
Indeed, it's very sad. If you make a trip right now to Marikana, and you don't have to have seen the conditions in 2012 for you to understand that there hasn't been any development. A huge percentage of the miners that work at Sibanye Stillwater live at a settlement called Kari or Kanini. And this is an informal settlement heavily populated by sheikhs. And these people are the main resource of Sibanye Stillwater. And at the same time, on the other hand, Sibanye Stillwater in 2006 came up with a social labor plan where they promised that they would build 5,000 houses for the miners. And this was not out of any legal obligation. They made this promise voluntarily. By 2012, when they appeared before the commission, do you know how many houses they had built? None. And this was a promise that they made voluntarily. Then comes the Falun Commission and it makes the same recommendation that Sibanye Stillwater, I mean, Lonmin at the time, and Sibanye Stillwater, because they took over on a going concern, they make the recommendation that they must at least try their best to improve the conditions around Marikana. If you travel to Marikana now, you see that there is a very big issue of housing. People are still staying in informal settlements. There's issues around basic services. There's no water. People have to take wheelbarrows and go to the river to find water. They have to, more than 1,000 people have to set 2 taps, which can barely provide clean water. There is no roads around the mine. There is basically a big lack of basic services. And these are the things that not only the Falun Commission made as a recommendation. These are issues that the mine in 2006 came up with a plan that they are going to actually provide these services on a voluntary basis. And more than 15 years later, the people in Marikana still live in the same conditions. It's really terrible. One last thing to highlight is that, and also the Falun Commission made a recommendation on the employment of family members of the deceased mine workers. And most of people look at this as a recommendation from the Falun Commission, but the families had to fight in order to at least make a living, because during the period of the Falun Commission, they were without any income and they were terribly disadvantaged socioeconomically. And This is such a huge disadvantage. We propose to the president that they must create a welfare fund which would allow the widows to actually retire and go home in the Eastern Cape, most of them, while earning a salary from the state. And the reason for this is, look at it in this way. The deceased mine workers were migrant laborers. They moved from the Eastern Cape, from Lesotho, from Swaziland, and they went and resided in Rustenburg so that they can make a living. And when they were killed, their wives had to take up employment, leaving children now being orphaned at home. And in order to avoid this, we propose that there must be a welfare fund created for Marikana families. We should cater for come in as a salary, while the person who was in the mine, which is the widow, can go back home and raise their children and raise their grandchildren. So there's so many issues around the socioeconomic welfare in Marikana, whether it's in relation to basic services or just the welfare of the families.
Asinathi Tegela, attorney at Socioeconomic Rights Institute of South Africa, there with us. Bratsepo, I see you, and Mkululi, we're going to come to you and take your calls next and some voice notes. You can send yours as well, 0727021702, or you can call us on 011-883-0702.